with John Baldwin on 9th June 1981. So you were saying that it was suggested to you that this would be a good thing to work on, and you didn't really understand probably at the beginning how the 2C aerial could do that kind of a measurement.
Yes, I'm sure that wasn't my idea. But then I began to see, well, to understand how it could do it, and I suppose what one of the things of my thesis was to see whether it would try to see whether it was a sensitive method of actually measuring angular diameters, comparing essentially the visibility of the fringes with the zero baseline visibility, and to what extent it was affected by instrumental aberrations of various kinds.
So basically you had 2 points, and you assume a Gaussian source and come up with a rough measure of the size.
I think that's right, yes. So many of them were... there were rather few that I felt I could put limits on at all, and that was a source of controversy inside, well, a few of us at the time, because whereas the 2C survey had a very large number of objects in it, it's about getting on 2,000, there were only about 50 of them which I felt that this technique could actually put a limit on. And then in a few cases, find things that were really quite large.
What was the controversy over?
As to why the technique was so bad compared with the point source survey.
But this is some presumption on the nature of the angular sizes of the sources also, is it not?
No, it's a question of even for point sources.
In other words, your errors were unacceptably large too.
That's right.
To others.
And they say, well, why can't you put limits on most of the sources, for instance? And, you know, you could only say they're point sources, they're less than so many minutes of arc, but at least that ought to be possible. And then we would look at the records and say, well, you cannot say whether which way up this is even as to this source. So it was quite clear that there was a discrepancy there which we didn't understand in some way from a technical point of view, which was presumably this whole question of confusion and so on, which... As but a word didn't exist at the time.
But that hadn't come up yet, that
no,
question.
No, not at all, no.
Well, okay, let's go into that then. How did that come up?
I don't know who invented the word, but it began to come up when the results of the survey, either for particular regions of sky or the general statistical results, were actually in conflict with other people's results. Now, I can't remember the sequence of events there, whether it was the conflict on statistics with the Australians or whether it was conflict over particular regions where there was actually overlap in the sky. And then it broadened by, and this went on for several years, and it's in the Paris Symposium, was a lot of this.
Oh, yes. But now, this is interesting, though, because what you're saying, though, is that there wasn't any concern with it here until... You had this other survey to compare with, which means essentially a preprint from Mills or something like that. And I think that it was earlier than that that the concern arose. But
well, it may well be.
Because you yourself were not directly involved in these things. I guess is that a fair statement?
Well, no, except that I was very closely involved.
Yes.
The other two people who were doing this were John Shakeshop and John Thompson, and with Martin looking after them. And, I mean, I do remember on one occasion when they were doing the analysis that he came along and said that, and this was early days, that, you know, come on, you're not actually getting enough sources out of this, you know. What about this, you see? You've only put in these... one or two obvious things. What about this and this and this? I think what was not appreciated, certainly by me then, was that if you add together a lot of interference fringes modulated by a beam shape, and if you add together a lot of them with random phases and so on, you still get a structure which has got the fringes and the modulation characteristic of the beam shape.
Mm-hmm. So you had more too much confidence in that signature, so to speak, as
yes,
indicating reality.
I think that would be the And so that the survey was pushed further than it should have been. Now, well, I mean, one always probably ought to push a survey further than what you absolutely believe.
Right, and then bring it back.
And then decide, well, you know, what of that you do believe? Well, now, there were no criteria at the time for deciding what would be good and what would not be good. Various things were used as supplementary evidence. The fact that, for instance, in the Tusi aerial, you could actually change the phasing between the north and the south elements so that the relative contributions of different sources, different declinations, would vary. And if you found that the phase of the fringes didn't vary, mm-hmm. then that was supplementary evidence, or at least believed to be supplementary evidence, that in fact that we were looking at a specific object rather mm-hmm. than a mixture. But again, there was no quantitative estimate of how much reliance could be placed on that.
Well, but since this technique was there, then there must have been already some concern with mixtures, though, in the sense that you had these complex charts, and at some point you had to say, that's not a single source, that's a mixture, I can't write that down as a single source.
Yes, well, I can't have been part of those discussions, but my feeling is that it was not discussed at any fundamental level, mm-hmm. certainly. And I think, therefore, if you, for instance, look in the theses of people who are actually doing the analysis of that survey, that would be the best test of whether, in fact, yeah. it figured largely in there.
Well, John Shakeshaft in particular.
Yes.
You know, I haven't gotten to his yet. I've got.
But I would be very surprised if it appears mm-hmm. there in any substantial form at the 2C stage.
Right.
Now, whether it was mainly the conflict with the Australians or whether it was already at the, by that time, by the time the conflict developed, of course. You see, it took a long time for 2C to get published, which was not entirely our fault. It took a long, long time in press. And that wasn't published till 55, as far as I recall.
That's right.
By which time, the frequency of the 2C telescope had been changed. Observations were already in progress on 3C. And therefore we were beginning to be able to compare our own neo-noble stuff quite apart from any conflicts with the Australians.
Right, and I think it was not really until 56 that you would have gotten a preprint from Mills, because that first episode, first installment of his thing was 57.
Yes.
However, there may have been noises, perhaps as early as the 55 meeting at Jodrell Bank. I don't remember if Mills gave any preliminary results at that meeting. I'll have to check that.
54, wasn't it?
Well, there were two of them. 55 was the IAU symposium.
Ah, yes, that's right, yes.
Before okay. Dublin.
So it's 54, and the 54 was the meeting at which I probably said something about the Crab Nebula, which was untrue. I mean, the first of many things. Probably untrue.
It was the beginning of your career.
Right? That's right.
Well, having switched to the subject of meetings, there were these two meetings at Jodrell Bank. Do you have any particular impressions as a research student of people or results that were presented from either of those meetings?
Yes, of individuals. It was the first time I'd seen quite a number of people. Particularly from overseas, like people like John Hagen and so on. I think he was over there, over here for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, that's right, because of course that was the ninth centenary year of the Crab Nebula, 1954.
Oh, the ninth centenary, I see what you're saying. Yes, yes, 900 years, right.
Yes, and for which we held a party in Cambridge. We had
on July 4th?
Yes, and we had crab sandwiches, of course. Ether and John Hagen turned up for that. He was happy to be passing through, and he was amazed at us, I think.
Well, of course, any American is glad to take part in a party on July 4th also.
Yes.
That's interesting.
But anyway, there were various people of that kind, and I honestly forget who was there and who wasn't there in that meeting. You probably have details of this. I mixed up the two, but I mean, one of the two, there was Wozniakowski.
It's the 55 meeting, I think.
The 55 meeting, yes. But it was probably the first time that I'd whether it was the first time I'd been to Jodrell, also, maybe. So although I'd seen people perhaps at the RAS, I hadn't actually talked to people there. I think chiefly the thing that stands out in my mind was nothing to do with the meeting at all. It was actually going round their place and seeing the way they did things. That was, mm-hmm. which was obviously, it was a different setup in the feeling of the place. From there. It was, there was still quite a bit of the meteor stuff about, yeah. but the grass was mown better and things like that. The sort of the scale on which things were done was rather different than our own. But also, scientifically, I remember that one of the things that had come out of this survey of sources of large angular size from the 2C survey was one object that I'd found, which was very bright and very large in size. And I got its position. I knew nothing about it at all. And I didn't even know about, looking at optical charts of any kind or another, but one of the groups, and I don't know which group it was now, had on the walls of their office, they had charts from the Scalnati Plazo Atlas.
Yes.
And I looked at one of these, and I saw that it was the same area of sky, and I looked, and there was a little thing marked, which said 443 on it. And it was in the right place, so I kept my mouth shut. And when I got home, I then went and asked, I suppose, David Dewhurst, what on earth this thing was that was called 443. Because I don't think at that stage I'd actually looked at an atlas of any sort at all.
Hmm.
So that was the high point as far as I'm concerned.
What other impressions did you have of the way things were done at Jodrell?
But obviously, the different kinds of things were thought to matter. For instance, one of the things that was, which was a fair amount of attention was paid to at our end, was when we were making aerials and so on, there would be matching them and using slotted lines to make sure they were properly matched and putting quarter wave short circuits, just beyond the end of the dipoles and things of that kind. And then to find that at Jodrell this didn't seem to matter at all, or at least it was, in many cases wasn't done, and the matching didn't figure largely in their estimation. And perhaps for the reason that, in fact, it isn't often very important as for the power comes in, unless it's extremely badly matched. But it was then that I was aware that there were, in fact, different ways of doing it, whereas at the moment, until then, I only knew of one way of doing the subject. And then they did. They had their Zenith large dish, which was a very different kind of instrument than the ones that we had. And they weren't involved in interferometry at all.
Well, Jennison and Dasgupta must have been going. That was 52.
Yes, they
the
were.
Intensity interferometer.
That's quite right. Yes, now I remember seeing at least one end of that, the array that they had.
The thing that could move up about an Allori and so forth?
Yes. Yeah. And then there was, I suppose the sun was still comparatively important at that time as well.
Rod Davies did a little bit. But
was Maxwell was there? Was he doing the sun? Or was he doing ionospheric scintillation stuff, that's right. Mm. I knew there were various areas that were nothing to do with me that up till then I'd only associated with individuals like Tony Hewish doing ionospheric scintillation, but here were other people who were, some respects, the opposition and so on.
Did seeing this different approach to what one does in the field, did this tend to make you have a little bit less confidence in results that came from Jodrell because you weren't quite sure if it...
Oh, I don't think that would be true. I mean, I think we were suspicious of other people's results anyway, wherever they came from. Probably a fairly good tradition anyway, in most places. Unless you've actually done it yourself, you don't know whether to believe it or not. So I don't think that would change our view. But, I mean, like visiting a foreign country, one can always pick out the things that they do differently, which you think is being funny because they're foreigners.
Right. Continuing with the idea of meetings, did you go to Dublin for the 1955 IEU?
Yes, because that immediately followed the Jodrell meeting.
Do you have any particular recollections there of things that actually influenced what you did when you came back here?
Oh, no, I think I felt pretty lost there. I mean, I became aware that there was a vast number of astronomers throughout the world who were doing things that I had no notion of at all, that I said mainly optical astronomy, which I'd been to some extent aware of. I was still a research student, I suppose, at that stage, but I was actually able to give a paper. That amazed me somewhat, and to be taken slightly seriously by all these people. But they did think that radio astronomy was still quite a bit of a joke, I think, at the time.
Well, I was interested to see in that paper that you used the radio magnitude and the optical magnitude, and you said that the ratio was roughly constant for bright galaxies, and you were comparing M31 and the Milky Way. That was what the paper was about. But
oh, I see, yes. Well, now we were against radio magnitude.
Well, I was going to say,
but
to be honest, I didn't actually look at the paper. I looked at an abstract of it, and I was surprised to see this usage, because I thought that nobody did use it except Hanbury, Brown, and Hazard.
They'd used it, and I think John Bolton used it at some stage.
Oh, maybe he did too, right?
But I didn't. We certainly didn't want to use it. We may have been forced into it at one stage, but...
What was the objection to it? It's just very unphysical. I mean,
that's right.
Make the same mistake that the Greeks made in optical astronomy.
Yes, here we've got some actual absolute numbers, and then why go converting them? Although there was a very good reason, of course, if the optical numbers happened to be in that form, then it was, in fact, just a logarithmic scale, and the ratios were relevant.
But I get the impression, then, that you were really babes in the woods relevant to optical astronomy, that you just picked it up here and there as it became necessary.
Oh, yes, there was no kind of coherent body of knowledge or method of teaching even, although we were not very, students, we were not very closely aware of what was actually being done in the observatories, even though we'd go to talks there, and we would know some of the people.
But you wouldn't take a course of lectures on...
On optical astronomy, absolutely not, no.
Or positional astronomy, or something like that.
No. At some time, I think I perhaps did go to one course of lectures, and I can't quite remember how later that was, which dealt with the equation of transfer and things like that.
Were you taking a similar course on propagation through the ionosphere here in the Cavendish?
No, there were very, very few courses. The one course that did take place, which was very influential, was Jack Ratcliffe's course on Fourier methods. We had to go to some of the lectures on the atmospheric physics, which we didn't want to.
You didn't feel it was relevant to the radio?
No, it seemed completely irrelevant to the radio stuff.
The sort of stuff that Hewish was doing with the occultations and...
It obviously had an influence, but the kind of things that were problems for the ionospheric people as to, about total electron content, what were the recombination coefficients, what were these polar blackouts, and all this vocabulary, which was obviously some physics in itself, but was not physics that was in any way relevant to what we were doing. We didn't want to go, and so we would get out of it if we possibly could. And I suppose Martin was in a slightly difficult position in that he was having to push us to go to those because his boss was Jack Ratcliffe. We shouldn't be, as we were part of the group, we shouldn't be seen to be.
Well, speaking of Ratcliffe, I'd be interested in your opinion as to the role that he played. Obviously, as you became more of a senior member, you could see it better, but
in the 50s and early 60s, did he play a vital role, would you say, in the way the group developed in any sense? And if so, what was the contribution?
Well, he left in when? 59, I think.
I'm not sure.
I think that's right, that he went to to Slough, and Martin became professor. I think that's correct. I think he was very important in first suggesting that Martin should actually do radio astronomy. You've probably got recordings of that already. He was certainly important, I think, at the stage when we were trying to get funds for Lord's Bridge development. And he certainly did quite a bit of the work there, I believe.
No, Martin told me that.
Yes, he did, yes.
The contacts with Mullard and
yes,
and so forth.
That's correct, yes. He also took quite an interest for several years after I was first there in the papers that were written,
mm-hmm.
and would actually look at the paper, so that he looked at the 2C paper, for instance, and I remember his comments on that, which was that just because a piece of work has taken a long time to do, it doesn't mean that the paper should be correspondingly long. This paper is about three times too long. Which made us absolutely dejected in the usual way.
But did it really get cut back rather drastically?
Oh, yes. Yes, it certainly did.
So it had to have his approval before it would go off.
That was the feeling, yes. But now I don't know that he did that on all papers at that stage.
But was this overall a healthy influence, do you think?
Oh, yes, clearly. Yes, I mean, however much one fights against it, one does need people who are slightly detached from the piece of work to say, well, this is irrelevant.
I need those words now. I'm depressed about it. All the things I'm having to say to my thesis. But I gather then you haven't mentioned anything about any scientific influence, really, in the ideas of the group and so forth. That wasn't much of a...
No, I was unaware of that completely. I think, except for his important role in relation to Fourier analysis and a physical interpretation of that.
Yeah, you actually mentioned that previously, and several other people have brought up his lectures.
Well, it's the only course of postgraduate lectures I've ever been to, which really made an impression on me, I think.
Continuing along this line, last time you told the anecdote about Martin Ryle's talk at the RAS announcing the 2C results and how the Evening Standard got a hold of it and so forth, but you mentioned in a word that this made the debate so much more interesting, that these people came in tucking this tabloid in their pocket. But what can you actually remember about the discussion after that talk?
Well, the feeling from people who were opposed to it, and I can't remember, it wasn't the only occasion on which there was this debate, so they're probably slightly confused in my mind, but I imagine that Tommy Gold was there and Fred Hoyle was there and so on. And I don't know whether it was on that occasion or another occasion. I remember Tommy Gold saying, you claim that the sources are isotropically distributed. If you only just look back at your slide, it's quite clear that they're not. Even I can see there's a great hole in the distribution. Completely empty, you see. And that was the Southern Sky, of course, which was... So this, in a way, was the level at which the discussion was taken, but there was a feeling of sort of general astonishment and disbelief that from a set of observations of this kind in a field which was still very disconnected from optical astronomy, mm-hmm. that one could make such strong claims.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the feeling, but it was very difficult to actually harness the arguments to show that there were large areas of doubt or something.
Yeah.
So that all those arguments had not at that stage been rehearsed, but the objects had to be at large distances anyway, and that therefore the source counts were associated with some large-scale feature in the universe rather than a small-scale feature, and so on. It was early days then,
right?
And so it was a slight
bombshell. After the first battle or two.
Yes, then
one
got a vocabulary so they could actually discuss this problem. The first time it was a sort of a bombshell, yeah. Especially as the newspapers were saying, Genesis right, or whatever they did say. One can, well, you've probably looked that up anyway in the scrapbooks.
Do you feel that a part of the opposition from the steady state people was not just because it was against their theory, but that they were so flabbergasted that these claims were even being made? I mean, the presumptuousness to do it, that, you know, that if it had been more of a traditional optical program of some kind or something, they might have gone more into it, but it was the very upstartness of it.
Yeah, it was the suddenness of it, which, yes, was obviously a challenge, it seems to me, saying, you know, all what you've been doing is rubbish because the answer is this. That obviously would make anyone react strongly.
Yeah, yeah. Had there been any sort of conscientious policy, a la the pulsars, to not discuss this outside the group for several months beforehand and let it all come out? So I think you did mention that Martin actually had a press conference before this meeting.
Yes, he did, just immediately before the meeting, right. Well.
So obviously there was some feeling that this was an announcement, you know. I mean,
yes.
And that people didn't know it before, and now they were going to know it.
Well, have you got a date for the meeting?
It's 55. I don't...
Yes, but now it was 55, but it was before 2C was published.
Yes. No, that's
because cause that was delays in publication. It was to do with... It was in memoirs, and setting up times were long, and there were endless delays over that. So the actual... That was another point that actually, I think, raised some hackles in the opposition, in that the original data wasn't available for everybody to inspect. So the catalogue was still in press, so it's hard to actually attack it.
Preprints were not circulating.
Oh, preprints didn't exist.
I mean, this was just a matter of economics not reproducing, not having that capability.
Yeah, I mean, I had never at that stage seen a preprint. Not from us, but from anybody.
Well, I've found a certain number. I mean...
Oh, well.
But you tend to find more of them in the States where there was some more money, you know, to have mimeos and to run these sort of things off and so forth at that time.
But I don't think I had ever seen an earlier version of papers on radio astronomy from Jodrell or from Australia.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, that's interesting.
Yes.
So you really just had to wait for it to come out?
Yes. Or else hear it. And that was one of the reasons, actually, I think, perhaps for going more often to the RAS, that you heard new things there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it was a means of doing so.
Was it more true then that the talks were more interest at the meeting than just talking to people in the hallways? Whereas now it seems like very few people are actually interested in sitting and listening to the talks because of this aspect of it?
Oh, no, because for me it wasn't, because I think at that stage I didn't really know many people to go up to them and start talking to them at tea, unless they happened to be people of my own age, yeah. In Jodrell or something.
So it was still somewhat an educational process for you.
Yes, I think so.
Okay, one final meeting I'd like to ask about is the Paris Symposium, which it's always seemed to me was
rather critical meeting. It's almost the end of an era where you could have all the radio astronomers in the world almost.
It was the last time that solar radio astronomy has appeared among the rest.
Yes. And what are your recollections of that meeting?
The atmosphere was awful. I mean, as far as the our local business between us and the Australians and Jodrell and source surveys and confusion and that was the worst time ever. That period, it seems to me. And I still, my hands tremble when I open the book. Still, I fear the pages are going to burst into flame.
But I mean, can you be a little more explicit? What was the awfulness of it?
Well, it was that people arrived at that meeting in a very tense state. Already quite a lot of things had been said on either side. And I mean, we didn't believe what they were doing, they didn't believe what we were doing, and it had been said so. The kind of things that had appeared in papers were the results of Ryle et al. And so on, purport to show that something like that. This sort of tone of very far from scientific attachment. It was a battle, and really concerned with the person's competence in technique. Right, it wasn't scientific interpretation. That, we can all differ about that and not care too much at all, because we could all be wrong. But if you're actually saying the facts are this, as far as your observations are concerned, and somebody else saying the facts are quite different, then that's a very personal form of attack. And so there were a lot of people there, of course. So it was a great forum. They were looking forward, in a way, to a great set to. And although I was not personally involved, as I wasn't actually getting up and speaking, at least not in this session, or having to answer questions or anything of that kind, I felt very
You obviously were a member of this group.
That's right. Yes, and it was attack on us. So it was.
I can almost imagine in the atmosphere like a test match for the Ashes, or almost the Australians over here in the.
That's right. People would be sort of white-faced and tense and wouldn't be speaking to one another in the intervals and things like that.
How would it gotten this way? I mean, is it just fundamentally that the two groups are too far apart here in radio physics? Or if it had been 50 miles away, do you think it might have still, the same sort of thing might have happened?
I don't know. It's... hard to say. I mean, there was, between ourselves and Jodrell, there was some interchange at the time, I suppose. So that one was more aware of those as real people, that even if you disagreed with them. So that we did have disagreements with them, and some battles with them about issues that are no longer of importance at all. But it didn't reach the same pitch of intensity.
But from what you were saying, there was no one seemed to be interested in the Paris Symposium of really figuring out what was going on here. They were only interested in proving themselves right through whatever.
So it was mainly between us and the Australians, and then there were other people. Jodrell people coming in.
Hazard and Walsh.
That's right. Supposedly as a impartial outsiders and so on, but. We knew that they were committed to pencil beam instruments, so of course a pencil beam instrument was going to be right and interferometers were going to be rubbish. And so, their impartiality didn't count at all with us. They were just as much the enemy. And the kind of evidence that they put forward, we didn't believe. And
why not? I mean, in fact, I looked at that paper... just last week, interviewing Cyril Hazard, it seemed to me like it was not too bad a way to go about doing it.
Yes, now, without looking at it again, I can't recall exactly.
What they did was an interferometer and the single dish.
Yes. Now, it's a question of whether the capabilities of the two things, which were supposed to be rather similar, were in fact really, not similar.
Really were, yes.
Now, being able to look at that afterwards, I think one was able to reach that conclusion that, in fact, and I think that was looked at fairly carefully afterwards to see whether, in fact, it was providing new evidence or not. I mean, our immediate reaction was to say this is rubbish, but in a meeting you don't get the time to actually look at anything, decide whether it's right or not.
They concluded that one source for 25 beams was really as far as you should go.
I see, do they? Yes, well, I just don't remember.
Well, how did this situation get resolved? I mean, it would seem like this sort of thing ultimately has to have someone neutral come in to straighten it out. Was that what happened?
From
your point of view, how did it get resolved?
By then, of course, you see, that was 1958. By then, the 3C results were available, at least to us.
Yes. In fact, you were a co-author on a paper at the meeting of the initial 3C.
Oh, was I? Which said that the slope of the source counts was less steep. Ah, they said, yes, of course, right. Yeah. The number of sources in the survey, the limit to which we were going was much more conservative anyway. So again, other people said, yes, well, they're going the right way. But we were still saying that the slope was whatever it was, 1.8 rather than 2.2 or something for source counts. And that was still in disagreement. But Mills would be able to be saying, well, yes, it's gone. Bolton, I forget who it was now. Mills or Bolton, or both of them. They're saying, yes, well, if it's come down from 2.2 to 1.8, just leave it a bit longer and it'll come down to 1.5, which is what we think it is. So that although there was still a clear discrepancy, which we believed was a discrepancy, and that 1.5 was wrong, both sides could rationalise it and say, so they didn't lead to the same conflict. The other thing was, I think by that time, the large angular size sources that Mills had in his class 1 sources in galactic plane were clearly ones which we would never have pretended to see. They were very closely concentrated to the galactic equator, and therefore one should, you know, that was a separate issue, and you could forget about that, which had confused things earlier on.
Yes, yes.
So it was the high latitude sources with a different slope. The brighter sources were beginning to agree between Mills, and again, there was overlap there, and there was agreement among the brighter sources, but not among the fainter sources. On both sides were prepared to say, yes, well, your sources are wrong.
Well, what did you see as the main problem with the Mills survey?
Signal to noise, that he was scraping very, very close to the bottom of his survey. You know, only judging from a typical source that's published, showing what the signal to noise looks like, and then looking at the bottom of the catalogue and saying, well, now you're going down to those things which are limited by signal to noise. What about the side lobes of from the main arms of the cross as well? How many of those sources are really due to the sun?
Right. What about the problem of extended sources and whether they might break up into just not discrete sources, but structure in the galactic background? Was that important to you as a possible problem?
Well, it was. One knew that there was structure in the galactic background, and that indeed some of that had actually appeared in the large angular size survey that we had, which didn't correspond exactly with his objects and so on, but they were sufficiently few in number that I don't think we were particularly concerned about those. He was claiming, I think, that the behaviour of those could produce the source counts, the apparent source counts that we had, because we had an interferometer which was insensitive to most of the structure in the sky. We believed that that was not the reason. And for everybody else, I suppose they could say, well, if both sides give a bit, then there's not too much conflict anymore.
Do you think it's a fair statement to say that once Tusi came out and the Cambridge group realized that most of it was wrong, in a sense, but then they went back to P of D, which they stuck by, and then they came up with 3C and so forth, but...
Right, now, when was P of D actually, when did that come out?
It came out in 57.
Ah, yes. So that would also be talked about at the Paris Symposium.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. It was debated there. But what I was going to say is that to a large number of people, I mean neutral people also, not just the Australians, Cambridge's stock was low, and so they wouldn't take the trouble to look into what P of D really was. And
I suppose it was so, not yes. Easy,
and so you had to somehow recoup from that. It was an uphill battle.
Yes, I mean, I don't think, from my point of view, I didn't have the feeling that what one was doing was trying to persuade these other people that one was right, but one was just fighting the people who were saying contrary things. I mean, whether other people really believed what we were doing was right or not didn't figure very high.
Well, but the contrary things they were saying was that you were wrong, so in some sense I think you had to be arguing that you were right.
Yes.
It's a matter of whether you're on the defensive or the offensive, I guess, in a particular time. But...
Now, if they were going to show their heads and say, "This is, you know, you're talking, you're doing something which is rubbish," then of course we would fight them. If they, in fact, had said nothing but didn't believe what we were doing at all, I think then there would have been no conflict at all. I think that's right.
In retrospect, as you look back on this, do you think that this whole episode in the late 50s set back radio astronomy relevant to at least a certain part of astronomy as a whole, and in the sense that many astronomers would say, look, these guys can't get their techniques organized, I mean, we just can't believe anything, we're just going to have to go on and do our other things, and eventually, when they get their act together, we can start listening to their results.
It may have affected what other people's view of radio astronomy was. I didn't know about that myself. I don't know that it didn't that much affect the way the radio astronomy was conducted, I think. Because everybody knew that the main problems were technical problems that had to be overcome, and all this discussion in a way of the science of it was something that was you were aiming to do, and there were these violent arguments, but
was it clear how the technical problem was going to be solved?
It was clear that what one needed was better sensitivity and better angular resolution, and if you could do that at all, then you could believe all the sources, you could actually find out where they were, you could do all the optical identifications, all of these things which were on the limit of, or beyond the limit of what was possible.
So what you're saying is that you just needed to keep on going with the program that you'd had anyway.
Yes. Ignore, you know, all this talk outside was, in a sense, irrelevant to the main drive, which was really somewhere ahead.
Interesting. So there really wasn't any response here in that sense to all of this, except P of D, of course, was a response.
That's right.
Say, well, look, we can still get lots of useful things out of this. But other than that, it was the same program that would have been carried on even if everyone had accepted the results and there had been no Mills Cross and so forth.
I suspect so. I may be being quite naive about that as a sort of junior member of the group. But I don't know whether you've asked Martin about this.
Well, I don't think I asked him that specific question.
No.
One always thinks of these the day
but,
the day afterwards.
Certainly in what's emerged afterwards, looking back at old things that he has and so on, it's clear that many of the ideas of what was in principle possible were, in fact, quite early ideas, but therefore they would be developed if it was at all possible.
Right. No, he loaned me that notebook.
In, oh, yes, okay.
53, where you sort of have a 10-year program laid out there in one page.
Mm. Yes.
You mentioned the name of David Dewhurst a while back, and was he important in terms of introducing the group to optical astronomy in many ways?